But first to some fresh reflections on the drama in Mumbai as India continues to count its dead in this extraordinarily audacious attack in the commercial capital, which everybody is starting to grasp the sheer audacity of it. Here at Saturday Extra, we're going to try and make sense of the broader strategic implications of the violence. What did the heavily armed young men want to achieve by attacking 9 locations in Mumbai, very carefully chosen? What does the assault say about the future relations between India and Pakistan? And what are the implications for the global war on terror? Now, 3 days after this first began, as you'd have heard on AM, the situation on the ground is still unclear. But let's look beyond the immediate and what might follow in the coming months as the guesswork gives way to firmer knowledge. One man following this closely is strategic expert Dr. Sandy Gordon. He's visiting fellow at the Asia-Pacific College of Diplomacy at the ANU, and he's the former head of intelligence for the Australian Federal Police. He's also the author of India's Rise to Power in the 20th Century and Beyond. Sandy Gordon, welcome to Saturday Extra.
Thank you, Geraldine.
Look, there's been some very interesting writing today. Greg Sheridan's got a very good piece, I think, in the Australian today, suggesting, quoting actually Pramit Al-Chaudhry, whom we've had on the program a couple of times from the Hindustan Times, a very good strategic analyst, suggesting that the attack could have been a combined effort by Laskhar-e-Taiba and Al-Qaeda, suggesting that it would explain the slightly complex nature of the attacks, some aimed at killing Indians, some aimed at killing Jewish people from American Jewish organisations, some aimed at foreigners. This really, that's what's been so confusing. I wonder how you're seeing it.
Well, very much along those lines, although I'd have a somewhat different take. I certainly think that a group like Laskhar-e-Taiba could well be involved. But what we've seen in the past in India, and this goes right back really to 2001, we've seen a combination between a sort of homegrown Indian terrorism and groups like Laskhar-e-Taiba. They actually work really closely together. And more recently, we've seen that sort of combination in relation to a Pakistani group called Huji. Now, Huji is interesting because it, in fact, is an associate of Al-Qaeda, as is Laskhar-e-Taiba. So you can assume that probably a group like Huji or Laskhar-e-Taiba is involved, and that they are Al-Qaeda-like groups, but they're not necessarily in this particular instance in cahoots with Al-Qaeda. So I think he's broadly correct in saying that, but I would have a somewhat different take on it.
Mm. He says, this is quoting Pramit, there's a compelling strategic logic to a combined LET, Al-Qaeda joint operation, that LET hates the Indian state and is incensed that Kashmir, which it believes should not be part of India, is holding democratic internal elections. And also Al-Qaeda wants to show it can strike back against Western targets. And of course, if it at the moment we're on the point of the Pakistanis and the Americans all combining to fight those terrorists in the Western provinces that are attacking Afghanistan, if they can draw attention away from that, that suits Al-Qaeda. So it's this complex sort of strategic motives that might be at play here.
Well, look, that's certainly correct about the broad strategic motives. There's a fantastic amount at stake here. What these groups in total, whether they're Al-Qaeda, Laskhar-e-Taiba, Jaish Muhammad, Huji, whatever, what they want to do is to undermine both the broader, quote-unquote, war on terror, but also specifically to undermine the rapprochement between India and Pakistan, which has been in evidence since late 2003, and which has resulted in a diminution of the support from the Pakistani state for those groups fighting in Kashmir. So they do have a joint commitment, a joint set of strategic objectives. They're somewhat different objectives, as was just mentioned. There is the broader objective of drawing the Pakistani effort away from the tribal area so that Taliban and Al-Qaeda could operate with impunity into Afghanistan. That is certainly a very powerful objective. But there's also the other objective about Kashmir. And as well as that, there's the objective over the top of all of this, and that is what's called the so-called global jihad. So you put all that together, and there's a strong impetus. But I'd also add to that that a group like Jaish Mohammed or Lakshi Toiba, they're groups which have operated in this milieu for quite some time. I mean, for example, in Australia, a number of Australians have gone to train with Lakshi Toiba. They are an international group, notwithstanding that they were initially established with the support of the ISI, the Pakistani Military Intelligence, for specific activities in Kashmir. Now, this raises a broader question of whether the state, the Pakistani state, is directly involved in these events in India, outside of Kashmir, that is.
Yes, well, that's obviously a critically important judgment. And, you know, that was why Manmohan Singh coming out and being so public about in that nominating Pakistan, he's been a very moderate man. And, of course, there are elections on right now in India. So I just wonder what you think the impact, that sort of desire to do something, which actually in 2002 led to a very serious set of incidents, didn't it, that prevailed throughout most of 2002?
Well, it certainly did. I mean, as we know, the Indians mobilised and that there was a real danger of the two countries slipping into war and they're nuclear armed, so this was extraordinarily serious. Now, I mean, there's a couple of points here. Firstly, it is commonplace for Indian leaders, not necessarily of the ilk of Manmohan Singh, but certainly Indira Gandhi did this persistently, going right back. She referred to the foreign hand. It's electorally convenient. The question is, what does it mean? There are two things happening here. It's a fairly subtle distinction. There's obviously support from across the border in Pakistan, but the real issue to my mind is there a smoking gun indicating direct Pakistani official involvement, for instance, of the ISI in this?
Which is the security intelligence. Because they're not really, well, arguably, they're not under anybody's control anyway. So, I mean.
Well, that's true. What is a dangerous recent development is that they appear to have been involved in the bombing of the Indian embassy in Kabul, in which 60 people died. And even I think the Americans would see them in that way. So this seems a fairly dangerous departure. My reading so far is that while the ISI has clearly supported these groups, and that explains the types of weapons, the military type weapons, the hand grenades which were pre-positioned, all of that, they don't necessarily support them for these activities in places like Mumbai because it's just too dangerous. I think everyone in 2002 breathed a sigh of relief once the Indians found a way to back down out of this. But, you know, if it were...
Well, that was heavily brokered by the US, wasn't it? The US
was indeed
deeply involved, so they're going to have to do that again, aren't they, surely?
Well, they're doing it already. What's really interesting out of this is that the head of the ISI himself is reportedly, this is reported in this morning's Times of India, en route to India.
Yes, I've read
now,
that.
Now, I think if this is the case, this has probably got the Americans involved in that. I wouldn't see that happening without some real arm twisting on the part of both parties by the Americans. But that's an extraordinarily interesting development if it's in fact true.
Yes, that's, I think, a General Pasha, I think his name is.
That's right.
He's on his way.
Ahmad Shuja Pasha.
Yes. Look, there are so many things to talk about, but there's one very interesting observation you make in your writing, which I haven't heard anybody else say. Several attacks in Mumbai, including the rail bombings of 2006, have apparently targeted lines, business places and suburbs frequented by the Gujarati Hindu business community. What link are you drawing between the Gujaratis and the Islamic radicals?
Well, there's a specific link going back to the terrible riots which took place in Gujarat in 2002 under the tutelage of a Hindu-leaning BJP government under a man called Mahendra Modi, who's still there, incidentally, and touted perhaps to become much more prominent in the central BJP party. But these riots, up to 2,000 Muslims died. It's not quite clear how many died, but the police turned a blind eye, and there's even accusations of government connivance in the rioting. And certainly following the rioting, the government made every effort it could not to bring those responsible to justice, and the federal government had to eventually intercede to make this happen. Now, when this happened, interestingly enough, there was a lot of DVDs, video footage and things of these absolutely horrendous events which were circulated amongst the Muslim community in much the same way as the tapes of used to be circulated in the Islamic Revolution in Iran. And this really was a sort of a flag call for Muslims. It became a rallying point, these terrible atrocities. And they were a reflection of a series of other riots, the destruction of the mosque in Ayodhya in 1992 by Hindu zealots, the subsequent riots after that, which triggered the bombings in Mumbai in 1993, by Dawood Ibrahim, in which 260 people died. So there's a strong element of revenge in this. And this revenge, I would say it's there because if you look at the pattern of bombings in Mumbai, a couple of those bombings occurred in heavily Gujarati. The Gujaratis are the main business community in the Gujarati Hindus in Bombay, in Mumbai. And they're represented up on that western foreshore where the cool breezes come in from the Indian Ocean. And when you had the rail bombing in 2006, the line which was bombed was that western line. The other line, which all the mill workers come and things like that, wasn't touched. Similarly, a suburb called Ghatkopar was bombed twice. So also you had the 2003 bombings, which targeted the Jhaveri Bazaar, which is where all the jewelry and people are, and they're heavily Gujarati as well. So I think there's a definite message in this. And
also that the targeting of the counterintelligence chief who investigated the Mumbai bombings too.
Indeed, and also the ex-home minister of Gujarat was assassinated as well. So, you know, you can go on, and the temple which was targeted in Gujarat and so on. You know, there's a whole string of these things. But as well as with this and overlaid with it, there's this clear strategic targeting that goes beyond this, of which we've already discussed, yeah. I think.
Sandy, that's just a snapshot of what we'll be discussing this coming week. Thank you very much indeed for those insights.
You're most welcome.
Dr. Sandy Gordon, visiting fellow at the Asia-Pacific College of Diplomacy at the ANU and the former head of intelligence for the Australian Federal Police, who's also written, his book is called India's Rise to Power in the 20th Century and Beyond. It's a Palgrave Macmillan publication. Well, a great strategic analyst, Coral Bell, coming up next.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.